Rain drummed against the stained glass, casting bruised shadows across the stone floor. Josephine stood alone in her heavy silk gown. The groom was gone. He hadn't just fled. He'd taken the only thing she loved more than him, her younger sister. Most women would have wept, wilted, or faded into a convenient scandal. Josephine simply unpinned her veil, turned her back on the altar, and walked out. 10 years later, a ruined man knocked on her manor door. The corset was tied too tight. It was the first coherent thought Josephine Ashford had as she stood before the altar of St. Jude's. The whalebone dug into her lower ribs, restricting her breaths to shallow, useless gasps. She had been standing on the cold marble steps for 45 minutes. The air in the chapel was thick with the scent of damp wool from the coats of the congregation, mingled with the cloying sweetness of hundreds of white lilies. The flowers were already beginning to brown at the edges. Behind her, the murmurs had started 20 minutes ago. At first, they were polite, isolated whispers. A delay. A broken carriage wheel. A misplaced ring. But as the brass clock on the chapel wall ticked relentlessly forward, the whispers bled together into a low, buzzing hum that vibrated against the back of Josephine's neck. She stared straight ahead at the gilded crucifix above the altar. She did not turn around. If she turned around, she would have to look at the 300 members of London's high society who had gathered to watch the plain, practical, older Ashford daughter marry Arthur Pendleton, the Duke of Westford. Arthur was brilliant. He was wealthy. He possessed a smile that made sensible women forget their ledgers and unpin their hair. And he was late. The Archbishop of Canterbury stood a few feet away, shifting his considerable weight from one foot to the other. He cleared his throat, the sound sharp like a snapping twig in the echoing space. "Perhaps Lady Josephine," he murmured, leaning in so only she could hear, "we should retire to the antechamber, to wait." "We will stay right here," Josephine replied. Her voice was flat, calm. She gripped her bouquet of white roses until the thorns, expertly clipped by the florist, still managed to bruise the leather of her gloves. Where was Genevieve? Her younger sister, the maid of honor, had complained of a headache that morning and stayed behind at the townhouse, promising to follow in the second carriage. Josephine had brushed it off. Genevieve was 19, prone to dramatics, and chronically terrified of waking before 10 o'clock. Heavy footsteps echoed from the back of the nave. The buzzing of the congregation instantly died. Josephine allowed herself a single deep breath, ignoring the pinch of the corset. She braced herself to turn to offer Arthur a forgiving, composed smile. But the footsteps were too fast, too heavy to be a groom walking down the aisle. It was Thomas Rigsby Arthur's closest confidant. He was pale. His cravat was askew, and his boots were splattered with fresh street mud, a glaring offense against the pristine crimson runner. He didn't look at the congregation. He kept his eyes locked on the stone floor until he reached the altar steps. He bypassed the archbishop and walked directly to Josephine. He did not offer a bow. He simply extended a folded piece of heavy cream vellum. It lacked a wax seal.
"I am sorry, Joe," Thomas said. His voice cracked. He looked sick. "I only just found it, on his desk at the townhouse."
Josephine took the letter. The paper was expensive, thick beneath her gloved fingertips. She recognized the sharp, aggressive slant of Arthur's handwriting. She did not tear it open with trembling hands. She unfolded it, methodically smoothing the crease with her thumb.
"Josephine, I cannot do it. I thought duty would be enough. I thought affection could grow into something resembling the fire I need to survive. But I was lying to myself, and worse, I was lying to you. It is Genevieve. It has always been Genevieve. She is terrified of the scandal, but I have convinced her to leave with me. By the time you read this, we will be on a ship to Calais. Do not hate her. The fault is entirely mine. Forgive me. Arthur." Josephine read the words twice. The ink was slightly smudged on the word Genevieve. A teardrop, Arthur's or her sister's. It didn't matter. She did not scream. She did not swoon into the archbishop's arms. Something behind her ribs simply clicked shut, sealing itself away like a heavy iron vault locking down for winter. She felt a profound, sudden chill followed by an aggressive wave of practicality. Calais. They had taken the morning ferry. They were already gone. Lady Josephine. Thomas asked softly. The silence in the church was now absolute suffocating. 300 pairs of eyes burned into her spine. Josephine neatly refolded the letter. She tucked it into the bodice of her heavy silk gown. She looked up at the Archbishop. The wedding is canceled, Your Grace. She said, her voice carrying clearly through the cavernous space. You may return to your duties. She turned around. The sea of faces before her was a tapestry of shock, pity, and naked, greedy curiosity. Her father, Lord Ashford, was half out of his pew, his face flushed a dangerous mottled purple. Her mother had a hand pressed to her throat, her mouth opening and closing like a landed trout. Josephine walked down the steps. The 60 pounds of French silk and beadwork dragged at her shoulders like a penance. She kept her chin parallel to the floor, her eyes fixed on the heavy oak doors at the back of the chapel. Josephine! Her father barked, stepping into the aisle to block her path. What is the meaning of this? Where is the Duke? The Duke is on a boat to France, Josephine said. She did not lower her voice. If there was to be a scandal, she would not be the one whispering about it in corners. With Genevieve, excuse me, Father. She sidestepped him. Her mother made a high keening sound and collapsed into the lap of a dowager aunt. Josephine didn't stop. She walked the length of the crimson carpet, the heavy swish-swish of her gown, the only sound in the frozen room. She reached the vestibule, pushed open the heavy oak doors herself, and stepped out into the pouring rain. The cold water hit her face instantly, matting her meticulously curled hair to her cheeks. Her carriage was waiting. The driver, looking startled by her solitary emergence, scrambled to open the door. Josephine climbed inside, hauling the sodden mass of her dress in after her. Home, miss? The driver asked, peeking through the small window. No, Josephine said, leaning her head back against the velvet squabs. Take me to the bank. The fallout was spectacular, violent, and entirely unmanageable. For 3 weeks, the Ashford townhouse was under siege by journalists, debt collectors, and gossips disguised as sympathetic friends. Lord Ashford raged, threatening to duel Arthur if he ever set foot in England again. He contacted lawyers screaming about breach of promise and the return of the dowry. Lady Ashford took to her bed, claiming her heart was failing, though her appetite for the cook's roasted pheasant remained suspiciously robust. Through it all, Josephine sat in the study reviewing the family ledgers. The terrible truth, the one that had driven the marriage arrangement in the first place, was that the Ashfords were drowning in debt. Arthur's wealth was supposed to act as a life raft for their sinking estate. Without him, and with the added humiliation of Genevieve's elopement, the family credit vanished overnight. Merchants stopped extending lines of credit. The butcher demanded cash at the back door. What? We are ruined. Her father sobbed one evening, pouring his fourth glass of brandy. He looked 10 years older, the bluster drained right out of him. That bastard took your sister and he took our name. We have nothing. Josephine closed the ledger she was reading. She pushed her spectacles up her nose. We have Highcross, she said quietly. Her father waved a dismissive hand. Highcross is a miserable stretch of mud in Yorkshire. The sheep are dying of hoof rot and the manor roof is caved in. It hasn't turned a profit since your grandfather was alive. It is unencumbered by your London debts, Josephine pointed out. It is the only property you own outright. I want it. Lord Ashford blinked at her, his bleary eyes struggling to focus. You want it? Whatever for Josie, to live, to work. She stood up, smoothing her plain wool skirt. She had not worn silk since the day at the chapel. I will not stay in London to be pointed at in drawing rooms. I will not be the tragic, jilted spinster of Mayfair. Sign Highcross over to me, completely, in my name. He laughed a bitter barking sound. A woman running a sheep farm in the freezing north, You'll be back in a month begging for a warm bed. Sign it over father, or I will take my trust the small sliver of it you haven't gambled away and leave for America. You will never see me again. He signed it. 2 weeks later, Josephine boarded a northbound train. She took two trunks of sensible clothes, a box of agricultural manuals, and a singular burning resolve. High Cross was exactly as dismal as her father had described. The manor house was a hulking stone beast squatting on a windswept moor. The slate roof leaked into the upstairs hallway, ruining the plaster. The grounds were a chaotic mess of overgrown gorse and deep, sucking mud. The estate manager, a lazy, red-faced man named Mr. Clegg, laughed when she demanded the estate's financial records on her first morning. "Now, my lady," he chuckled, smelling strongly of stale ale. "These aren't things for a gentlewoman to fret over. You just make yourself comfortable by the fire, and I'll handle the rough work." Josephine fired him before noon. She gave him an hour to pack his belongings and ordered him off the property. The real work began. The first winter nearly broke her. The cold was a physical entity that lived in her bones. Her days began before dawn, the frost thick on the window panes. She learned the smell of lanolin, wet earth, and wood smoke. She walked the pastures in heavy leather boots, the hems of her skirts caked in freezing mud, inspecting the surviving flock. She hired a new foreman, a quiet, hard-eyed local named Thomas, a different Thomas, one who didn't deliver devastating letters, who respected her because she didn't flinch when a ewe had to be put down. Slowly, the bleeding stopped. Josephine fired the remaining incompetent staff and promoted the workers who showed grit. She took the meager profits from the first spring shearing and, instead of repairing the leaky manor roof, invested in a dozen imported merino rams to strengthen the bloodline of her flock. She stopped looking in the mirror. She didn't care that her hands grew calloused, her knuckles red and cracked. She didn't care that the sun baked a permanent smattering of freckles across her nose. The society girl who had stood terrified at the altar slowly died, replaced by a woman made of iron and moorland wind. While she built her empire of wool and mud, news of the world trickled in via old newspapers wrapped around supply deliveries. Arthur and Genevieve had married in Paris. They were the darlings of the continent. The Duke and his impossibly beautiful new Duchess threw lavish parties in Venice, summered in the Swiss Alps, and wintered in Monaco. Genevieve, the papers gushed, wore diamonds the size of robin's eggs and set the fashion trends for a dozen courts. Josephine read the clippings by the light of a single oil lamp sitting in a drafty room. She felt nothing. It was like reading a fairy tale about strangers. By her fifth year at High Cross, the Merino crossbreeds yielded a fleece so fine it sparked a bidding war among the Yorkshire textile mills. She negotiated the contracts herself, sitting in smoke-filled rooms with hardened industrialists, who quickly learned not to try and lowball the spinster of High Cross. By her seventh year, she bought the neighboring failing farm, doubling her acreage. She repaired the manor roof. She installed indoor plumbing. By her 10th year, Josephine Ashford was one of the wealthiest independent landowners in the north of England. She was 34 years old. She wore severe tailored wool gowns that cost more than most men made in a year, and she answered to no one. Meanwhile, the newspaper clippings had changed their tune. The Duke of Westford's mining investments in South America had collapsed. The Duchess of Westford had racked up astonishing gambling debts at the roulette tables in Monte Carlo. The London townhouse was quietly sold. The country estate was heavily mortgaged. Then the final clipping. A tiny paragraph on the fourth page of the Times. The Duchess of Westford, formerly Miss Genevieve Ashford, has reportedly taken up residence in Rome with the Italian railway magnate Count Valerius. The Duke remains in London. Legal proceedings regarding his bankruptcy are expected to commence next month. Josephine threw the paper into the fireplace and watched it burn. She poured herself a measure of dark peaty whiskey, drank it neat, and went back to her ledgers. The storm blew in off the moors with violent intent. It was late November, the kind of night where the wind screamed down the chimneys and the rain lashed against the heavy glass windows like thrown gravel. Josephine sat in her study. The room was fiercely warm, the massive stone hearth roaring with a fire of seasoned oak. The walls were lined with books, not poetry or light fiction,
but volumes on soil chemistry market economics and steam-powered weaving looms. She sat at her broad mahogany desk, a gold-nibbed pen moving rhythmically across a stack of shipping manifests. She liked the storm. She liked knowing she had built walls thick enough to keep it out. The heavy oak door to the study opened with a quiet creak. Mrs. Gable, her housekeeper of 8 years, stood in the threshold. The older woman looked deeply unsettled, her hands wringing her apron. "I am sorry to disturb you, ma'am," Mrs. Gable said, her Yorkshire accent thick with hesitation. "But there is a man at the kitchen door. The dogs raised a terrible racket, and when Cook opened it, he nearly fell inside." Josephine didn't look up from her numbers. "A vagrant. On a night like this, give him a bowl of stew, let him sleep by the stove in the stables, and send him on his way at first light with a shilling." "I offered, ma'am. He won't take the stew, and he won't go to the stables. He asked for you, by name." That made Josephine pause. She set her pen down. The gold nib clicked sharply against the glass inkwell. "Did he give a name?"
"He said to tell you..." Mrs. Gable swallowed hard. "He said to tell you the Duke of Westford is here."
The silence in the study grew heavy, pressing inward against the roaring fire. Josephine stared at the flickering light on her desk. 10 years. 10 years of freezing mud, calloused hands, and relentless grinding work. 10 years of rebuilding her soul from the ashes of a public humiliation. She thought of the letter. It has always been Genevieve. "Is he armed?" Josephine asked calmly.
"No, ma'am. He looks... well, he looks half dead, if I'm being honest." "Bring him in here. Have Thomas stand in the hallway."
"Yes, ma'am."
Josephine stood up. She did not check her reflection in the glass of the window. She did not smooth her dark green wool dress. She walked over to the fireplace, folded her hands behind her back, and waited. 2 minutes later, the door opened again. If Mrs. Gable had not announced him, Josephine would not have recognized the man who walked into her study. Arthur Pendleton, the brilliant, devastatingly handsome Duke of Westford, was gone. The man who stood dripping onto her Persian rug was a ghost. He was agonizingly thin, his collarbones jutting sharply against the fabric of a coat that was frayed at the cuffs and smelled of wet dog and stale gin. His dark hair, once perfectly styled, was plastered to his skull, graying heavily at the temples. His boots were held together by mud and twine. He was shivering uncontrollably.
He stopped a few feet inside the room, his eyes scanning the opulent warmth of the study, before finally settling on Josephine. For a long moment, neither spoke. The wind howled outside, rattling the window frames. "You look well, Josie," he whispered. His voice was cracked, the aristocratic drawl worn down by exhaustion. "Do not call me that," Josephine said. Her voice was conversational, pleasant even. That was the most terrifying part. She felt no rage. Looking at this pathetic, broken creature, she realized the anger had burned out years ago, leaving only cold ash. "You do not have the right to use that name. You will address me as Miss Ashford." Arthur flinched as if she had struck him. He slowly nodded. "Miss Ashford, I apologize."
"What are you doing in Yorkshire, Arthur?" "The society pages placed you in London, dodging your creditors." He let out a dry, rasping laugh that ended in a wet cough. "There is no more dodging. They took it all. The townhouse, the country estate, the paintings, the silver. Even my father's pocket watch. It's gone. The bankruptcy was finalized last Tuesday." "And Genevieve?" Josephine asked, probing the wound to see if it still bled.
Arthur closed his eyes. A look of profound, sickening agony washed over his gaunt features. "She left. When the money ran out, she left. Valerius can afford to keep her in diamonds. I couldn't."
"A poor investment on your part, then?" Josephine said smoothly.
"Running away with a woman whose loyalty is entirely conditional on the depth of your pockets. You were supposed to be a brilliant man, Arthur. The math doesn't add up.
He looked at her, his eyes shining with unshed tears. I know. God, I know. I was a fool. A blind, arrogant fool. I destroyed the best thing I ever had for a fever dream that burned me to the ground. He took a step forward. I have thought of you every day. Every single day as my life fell apart, I thought of you standing at that altar. The guilt, it has eaten me alive.
I am not interested in your guilt, Josephine said, cutting him off cleanly. Guilt is a useless emotion. It fixes nothing and it pays no wages. Why are you in my house? Arthur swallowed. He looked down at his ruined boots. The last remnants of his pride seemed to visibly drain out of him, pooling in the muddy water at his feet.
I have nowhere else to go, he said, his voice breaking. My friends in London will not even receive me at their back doors. I am a pariah. I haven't eaten a hot meal in 4 days. I walked the last 20 miles from the train station because I didn't have the fare for a cart.
He fell to his knees. The heavy thud of his bones hitting the floorboards echoed in the quiet room. I am not asking for forgiveness, Arthur pleaded, staring up at her from the floor. I am not asking for you to take me back. I know you despise me, but I heard you run the largest estate in the county now. I heard you are ruthless but fair.
Josephine watched him, the Duke of Westford, kneeling on her rug. I know horses, he said desperately, his words tumbling out in a rush. I know ledgers. I can read Latin and French. I can keep accounts. I will mend fences. I will shovel out the stables. I will sleep in the hayloft. Please, Josephine, Miss Ashford, I am begging you. Let me work for you. Let me be your servant. Just give me a roof and enough food to keep me alive.
Josephine looked down at him. She thought of the heavy silk dress. She thought of the cold chapel. She thought of her father crying into his brandy in the first winter at Highcross when she had cried so hard from the cold she had thrown up in a snowbank. She walked slowly from the fireplace, crossing the room until she stood directly above him. He looked up, his eyes wide, terrified, completely at her mercy.
You want to be my servant? She stated.
Yes.
You want to keep my ledgers, the very ledgers that track the wealth I built because you left me with nothing.
Yes.
You will not live in the manor, she said, her voice dropping to a hard, authoritative clip. You will live in the foreman's old cottage by the north pasture. It is drafty. It smells of sheep. You will take your meals with the field hands in the external kitchen. You will not speak to me unless spoken to. If you are caught drinking, you will be fired. If you are caught slacking, you will be fired. You will be paid 10 shillings a week, the same as a junior stable boy. Arthur's shoulders slumped. He let out a shuddering breath, pressing his forehead toward the floor in a gesture of absolute submission.
Thank you. Thank you, Miss Ashford.
Do not thank me yet, Arthur, she said coldly, turning her back on him and walking back to her desk. You haven't survived the winter, Mrs. Gable. The housekeeper appeared in the doorway almost instantly. Take the new stable hand to the kitchens, Josephine ordered, picking up her gold-nibbed pen. Feed him. Then have Thomas show him to the north cottage. His shift begins at 5 in the morning. Arthur pulled himself to his feet. He gave her a low, awkward bow, turned, and followed the housekeeper out of the warm study, out into the cold halls of the empire she had built. Josephine dipped her pen in the inkwell. She did not watch him leave. She had a shipping manifest to finish. 5 o'clock in the morning on the Yorkshire moors did not arrive with a gentle sunrise. It arrived like a punishment. Arthur's first week at Highcross was a blur of physical agony. The North Cottage was exactly as Josephine had promised, a damp, single-room stone hut that smelled permanently of wet lanolin and wood rot. The fireplace smoked. The mattress was stuffed with coarse hay that poked through the thin ticking. He woke on the first morning to the sound of a fist hammering against the splintered door. It was Thomas, the estate foreman. Thomas was a man carved from the local granite with eyes like chipped flint and a mouth that rarely moved past a grim line. He handed Arthur a heavy iron pitchfork and a pair of stiff leather gloves. Mucking out, Thomas said. He did not call Arthur your grace. He did not call him sir. the lower barn, 30 stalls, done before breakfast. Arthur took the pitchfork. His hands, though thin, had never known a day of hard labor. For 32 years, his heaviest burden had been a crystal decanter or a pair of dueling pistols. By the time he finished the fifth stall, the skin on his palms had rubbed raw. By the tenth, the blisters tore open, weeping clear fluid and blood into the coarse leather of the gloves.
He did not stop. He shoveled the heavy ammonia-soaked straw into the wheelbarrow, pushed it out to the freezing muck heap, and went back for more. His muscles, atrophied from months of poor diet and heavy drinking in London, screamed in protest. Every push of the pitchfork sent a shockwave of white-hot pain up his spine. He focused on the rhythm. Push, lift, dump.
When the 30 stalls were finally clean, Arthur staggered to the external kitchen. He stood at the end of the line of field hands, shepherds, and stable boys. They watched him with a mixture of suspicion and dark amusement. The story of the broken lord who had crawled to the spinster's door had spread through the staff in under an hour. The cook handed him a tin bowl of thick, unsweetened oat porridge and a mug of weak tea. Arthur sat on a wooden bench in the corner, his hands shaking so violently he spilled the tea on his muddy trousers. He ate every bite of the porridge. It tasted like ash, but it was fuel. Days bled into weeks. The physical work was relentless. Arthur repaired dry stone walls, hauling heavy irregular rocks until his fingers were numb. He chopped wood until his shoulders locked. He helped herd the massive merino rams getting knocked into the frozen mud more times than he could count by the aggressive curled horn beasts. He learned to keep his head down. He spoke only when necessary. He took his 10 shillings a week walk to the village on Sunday afternoons, bought a single bar of carbolic soap and a tin of cheap tea, and walked back. He saw Josephine only from a distance. She was a ghost that haunted the edges of his vision. Sometimes he saw her riding a tall bay gelding across the upper ridges, inspecting the fence lines. Sometimes he caught a glimpse of her dark wool skirt sweeping across the courtyard as she moved between the manor and the estate office. She never looked his way. She never asked Thomas how the new hand was faring. She had erased him. He was no longer Arthur Pendleton, the man who had ruined her life. He was a tool in her shed, a cog in her machine. One evening in mid-January, the temperature plummeted, threatening a deadly frost. The entire staff was mobilized to move the most vulnerable ewes into the lower barns. It was brutal, chaotic work in the pitch black, lit only by swinging storm lanterns. Arthur was wrestling a terrified, thrashing ewe toward the barn doors when he slipped on a patch of black ice. He went down hard, his knee striking the frozen cobblestones with a sickening crack. The sheep bolted. Arthur lay in the mud, gasping for breath, waiting for the pain to subside. A shadow fell over him. He looked up, squinting against the glare of a lantern. Josephine stood there. She wore a heavy tweed men's overcoat over her dress, her hair pinned back ruthlessly, catching the sleet. She stared down at him. Arthur braced himself for a reprimand. He tried to scramble to his feet, favoring his screaming knee, the mud clinging to his jaw. Josephine didn't offer a hand. She watched him struggle upright. "You lost the ewe," she said flatly.
"I will retrieve her, Miss Ashford." Arthur wheezed, booing his head. "She went toward the copse. Do not come back to the barn without her." She turned and walked away, her boots crunching sharply on the ice. Arthur watched her go. He wiped the freezing mud from his mouth, limped toward the dark line of trees, and found the sheep. He was a servant, and he had an order.
By February, Arthur's body had begun to adapt. He was no longer skeletal. The grueling labor and the steady, if plain, diet had packed lean, hard muscle onto his frame. His hands were thick with calluses, the blisters replaced by a permanent layer of hardened skin. The gray at his temples remained, but the hollow, haunted look in his eyes had settled into something quieter, a grim endurance. He was shoveling out the main courtyard when Thomas approached him. "Leave the spade," the foreman grunted. "The mistress wants you in the estate office. Wash your hands first. You smell like a dead badger." Arthur froze. In 3 months, Josephine had spoken to him exactly once the night he dropped the ewe.
He scrubbed his hands raw at the outdoor pump, the freezing water stinging his knuckles, and walked to the stone outbuilding that served as Josephine's command center. He knocked. "Enter," her voice called out, crisp, unbothered. Arthur stepped inside. The office was chaotic, but immaculately clean. Maps of the county were pinned to the walls. Tall wooden filing cabinets lined the perimeter. Josephine sat behind a large oak desk buried beneath a mountain of paperwork. Her young clerk, a nervous local boy named Higgins, was standing beside her, looking like he was about to cry. Josephine didn't look up. She was pointing a silver letter opener at a stack of documents. "Mr. Higgins, I do not care that the man has an accent," she snapped. "I care that his figures do not match the agreed-upon price per fleece. These are shipping manifests for the Antwerp textile mills. They are in French. You told me you spoke French."
"I do, Miss Ashford," Higgins stammered.
"A bit? But the legal terms, the exchange rate clauses, it's very dense. Dense is not an excuse for losing me £200 on a tariff discrepancy." Finally, she looked up. Her eyes snapped to Arthur, standing quietly by the door. She looked him up and down, taking in his worn canvas trousers and the heavy wool sweater that smelled of the barn.
"You said you could read French and keep accounts," Josephine said. It wasn't a question.
"I can, Miss Ashford," Arthur replied, keeping his voice neutral. Josephine stood up. She gathered a thick stack of vellum contracts and slammed them down on a smaller side table near the window. She placed a pot of black ink and a pen beside them. "Higgins, go help Thomas with the inventory. Arthur, sit." Higgins scrambled out of the room like a rat escaping a sinking ship. Arthur walked over to the side table. He did not sit. He waited until Josephine had returned to her own desk and resumed writing before he pulled the wooden chair out. He looked down at the contracts. The legal jargon was dense, archaic French standard for international textile trade. He picked up the pen. It felt impossibly light in his thick, calloused fingers. For the next 4 hours, the only sound in the office was the scratching of two pens and the ticking of the wall clock. Arthur worked methodically. As he read through the manifests, his initial focus on translation gave way to genuine shock. He had known Josephine was successful, but seeing the raw numbers, the volume of fleece, the negotiated prices, the sheer scale of the empire she had built from a ruined, muddy sheep farm was staggering. She wasn't just surviving, she was dominating the northern market. She had cornered the Belgian buyers, outmaneuvered the local squires, and built a capital reserve that rivaled what his own family had possessed at their height. And she had done it entirely alone. He found the discrepancy. The Belgian buyer had hidden a predatory exchange rate clause deep in the third page of the shipping terms, relying on the fact that a Yorkshire farmer wouldn't catch the nuance of the Parisian legal phrasing. Arthur finished his calculations, wrote a neat summary on a fresh sheet of paper, and stood up. He approached her desk and laid the paper down.
"The error is intentional, Miss Ashford," Arthur said quietly. "They are attempting to lock you into a fixed exchange rate from 3 months ago before the franc dropped. If you sign this, you lose roughly 12% of the total profit to currency fluctuation." Josephine picked up his summary. Her eyes scanned his neat, precise handwriting. She didn't say a word for a long minute.
"Can you draft a counterclause?" she asked, her eyes still on the paper. "In the same legal phrasing, reversing the liability to the buyer."
"Yes?"
"Do it." Arthur returned to the side table. When he finished, he handed her the revised contract. She read it, nodded once, and set it aside. "Return to the courtyard," she instructed, picking up her next ledger. "There is still an hour of daylight. Tell Thomas to put you on the woodpile."
"Yes, Miss Ashford," Arthur said.
He turned to leave.
"Arthur!"
He stopped at the door, his heart giving a strange, painful thud against his ribs. He looked back. She wasn't looking at him.
"Your French is acceptable," she said to her ledger. "Wash thoroughly tomorrow morning. You will ride with me to York for the winter market. I require a clerk who can carry the strong box and translate. Higgins is a liability."
"I understand," Arthur said. He bowed his head
and stepped out into the freezing wind, his hands aching for the heavy familiarity of the axe. The York Winter Wool Market was a chaotic collision of mud money and shouting men. The central square of the city was packed with massive wooden stalls stacked high with raw fleece-graded wool and imported textiles. It smelled of roasting meat, damp wool, and the sharp, coppery tang of ambition. Josephine moved through the crowd like a warship parting a fleet of dinghies. She wore a tailored coat of dark charcoal wool, unadorned and entirely practical, but cut with a severity that commanded immediate respect. Men tipped their hats as she passed. Competitors moved out of her way. Arthur walked two paces behind her, carrying a heavy iron-bound strongbox under one arm and a thick leather satchel of contracts under the other. He wore his cleanest work clothes, a coarse woolen jacket, and a flat cap pulled low over his graying hair. He was practically invisible, just another hired hand trailing behind a wealthy master. He preferred it that way. For 3 hours, they visited the major merchant stalls. Josephine negotiated ruthlessly. She didn't raise her voice, but her flat, unwavering refusal to drop her prices by even a penny made seasoned merchants sweat in the cold air. Arthur stood silently at her shoulder, producing the correct documents the moment she extended her hand, acting as her silent shadow. It was mid-afternoon when they approached the largest pavilion in the square. It belonged to the primary buyer for a major London textile conglomerate. Standing beneath the awning was Lord Campbell. Arthur's stomach dropped. Campbell was a minor baron, a man who used to frequent the same high-stakes card games Arthur had patronized in London. He was loud, boastful, and notoriously vicious to anyone beneath his station. Josephine approached the table. "Lord Campbell, I have the revised contracts for the spring shearing. You will find the volume increased by 10% and the price per pound adjusted accordingly." Campbell, wrapped in an ostentatious fur-lined coat, looked down his nose at her. He sneered. "Ah, the spinster of High Cross. Still playing the merchant, I see. My directors in London are growing tired of your inflated prices, Miss Ashford. I am offering you 5% less than last year. Take it, or we buy from the Scots." "The Scots' wool is coarse," Josephine replied smoothly. "Mine is Merino Cross. You cannot run your fine looms on Scottish bristle without breaking the machinery. You will pay my price, or you will have no fine cloth for the spring season." Campbell flushed angrily. He leaned forward, planting his gloved hands on the table. "You overstep, woman. You forget your place." He glanced past her shoulder, intending to sneer at her hired help. His eyes locked onto Arthur. Campbell froze. He squinted. Then a slow, malicious grin spread across his face, revealing stained teeth. "Good God!" Campbell breathed. He let out a bark of laughter that turned the heads of several nearby merchants. It cannot be. Pendleton Arthur, Pendleton." Arthur stood perfectly still. The heavy strongbox dug into his ribs. He felt the eyes of the market turning toward them. He felt Josephine stiffen slightly, though she did not turn around to look at him. "Look at you." Campbell crowed, stepping out from behind the table. He reached out and flicked the coarse fabric of Arthur's jacket. "The Duke of Westford carrying a spinster's bags like a common footman. I heard you went bankrupt, Arthur, but I didn't realize you had sunk to playing a lapdog in the mud. Where is your beautiful duchess? Did she run off with the silver?" A few merchants nearby snickered. The humiliation was sudden, sharp, and absolute. It burned hot in Arthur's chest, an old aristocratic pride roaring to life, demanding he strike the man, demand satisfaction, defend his honor. But he had no honor left, and he was not the Duke of Westford. Arthur looked Campbell dead in the eye. He did not flinch. He did not drop the strongbox. "I am the clerk for the High Cross estate, my lord," Arthur said. His voice was calm, carrying clearly over the murmur of the crowd. "My employer's time is valuable. She has presented you with a fair contract. If you do not intend to sign it, I will pack the documents away so she may offer the fleece to the Belgian syndicate." Campbell's smirk faltered. He looked at Arthur, trying to find the broken man to mock, but found only a stone wall.
The Belgians. Campbell scoffed, trying to regain the upper hand. They won't pay those prices. I negotiated with their representatives yesterday. Arthur lied smoothly, his face utterly blank. They are prepared to sign at noon tomorrow. Shall I put the papers away? Miss Ashford, Josephine did not miss a beat. Yes, Arthur, we are done here. She turned to leave. Wait, Campbell snapped. Panic flared in his eyes. If he lost the High Cross contract, his directors in London would have his head. Wait, give me the damn pen. Josephine stopped. She slowly turned back. She did not hand him the pen. She gestured slightly to Arthur. Arthur stepped forward, unlatched the satchel, and withdrew the contract and a travel inkwell. He laid them neatly on the table. He stood back and watched as Lord Campbell, his face a mottled, furious red, hastily signed the document. "A pleasure doing business, Lord Campbell," Josephine said. She didn't wait for a response. She walked away. Arthur packed the signed contract away, secured the satchel, and followed her out of the pavilion, leaving Campbell fuming in his fur coat. They walked in silence to the edge of the market where their carriage was waiting. The driver took the strong box and strapped it to the rear. Josephine stepped into the carriage. Arthur closed the door behind her and moved to climb onto the exposed bench beside the driver. "Arthur!" Her voice cut through the cold air. He paused, looking through the open window of the carriage door. She was sitting in the gloom, her face unreadable. "Get inside," she ordered. Arthur hesitated. Servants did not ride inside the carriage. "Miss Ashford, my boots are muddy. I will ruin the floorboards." "Get inside," she repeated. Arthur opened the door and climbed in. He sat on the bench opposite her, keeping his posture rigid, his muddy boots tucked as far back as possible. The carriage lurched forward, beginning the long, cold journey back to High Cross. For miles, the only sound was the rattle of the wheels and the rhythmic clopping of the horses. The gray Yorkshire landscape rolled past the windows. "You lied to a peer of the realm," Josephine said suddenly. She wasn't looking at him. She was staring out the window. "I protected the estate's interests," Arthur replied quietly. "He humiliated you." "He told the truth. I'm a servant carrying bags. There's no humiliation in acknowledging what one is." Josephine finally turned her head. She looked at him, really looked at him for the first time since he had knelt on her study rug. She saw the new lines around his eyes, the hardened jaw, the quiet, heavy stillness that had replaced his former arrogant charm. "You did well today," she said. The words were brief, devoid of warmth, but they hung in the small space of the carriage with undeniable weight. "Thank you, Miss Ashford." She turned back to the window. The ice had not broken, but for the first time in 10 years, there was a tiny microscopic fracture in the surface. Arthur closed his eyes and let the rocking of the carriage carry him home. March arrived not with the promise of spring, but with a brutal screaming freeze. It was lambing season, the most dangerous and critical time for the High Cross estate. The moors turned into a battlefield of sleet and frozen mud. Arthur had not slept more than 3 hours a night in a week. He moved through the cavernous lambing sheds with mechanical efficiency, a lantern in one hand and a bucket of warm water in the other. He smelled permanently of birth blood and iodine. He no longer felt the cold. He had become an extension of the farm, moving with a singular, desperate purpose to keep the new flock alive. A week into the season, a severe squall hit. The wind tore the slate from the roof of the northernmost barn, exposing 50 pregnant ewes to the freezing rain. Josephine was in the shed when it happened, her sleeves rolled up past her elbows, her forearms slick with amniotic fluid from turning a breached lamb. When the roof cracked, the sound was like a cannon shot. Panic erupted. The sheep thrashed their bleats, deafening in the enclosed space. "Get them to the main barn!" Josephine shouted over the howling wind, grabbing a wooden hurdle to funnel the animals. Thomas and the other hands scrambled, but the sheep were terrified, clustering in the corners as the freezing water poured in. Arthur didn't wait for orders. He waded into the crushing mass of heavy, wet wool. He grabbed a struggling Yu by the horns, physically dragging her toward the heavy double doors. "Here!" he roared at the younger hands, his voice cutting through the panic, with the sharp, authoritative cadence of a man born to command, even if he was currently covered in muck. "Form a line, pass them through." For 3 hours, it was a waking nightmare. They wrestled the animals through the biting sleet, slipping in the mud, entirely exposed to the storm. Arthur carried the newborn lambs against his chest, tucking them inside his coat to keep them alive while he dragged their mothers forward. By the time the last ewe was secured in the main barn, the staff was battered and exhausted. Josephine stood by the lantern counting the flock. Her face was pale, her hair plastered to her skull.
"We lost 3, she said quietly, "but the rest are secure." She looked up. Her eyes found Arthur. He was leaning heavily against a wooden post, his chest heaving. His lips were entirely blue. He had given his thick wool coat to wrap a pair of orphan twins, and he stood in only his soaked canvas shirt. As she watched, his eyes rolled back and he collapsed into the straw. When Arthur woke, he was not in the damp, freezing North Cottage. He was lying in a bed with a heavy down quilt. The room was small, but the walls were dry and a modest fire burned in a brick hearth. It smelled of lavender and clean linen. He tried to sit up, but a vicious, rattling cough tore through his chest, forcing him back down. The door opened. Mrs. Gable, the housekeeper, bustled in, carrying a tray.
"Lie still," she ordered, setting the tray on the bedside table. "You've got inflammation of the lungs. The doctor said if you had stayed in that drafty cottage another hour, you'd be dead." Arthur stared at the ceiling. "Where am I?"
"The servants' quarters in the main manor," Mrs. Gable replied, pouring a cup of dark, foul-smelling medicine. "Miss Ashford ordered Thomas to carry you up here. Drink this. It tastes of tree bark, but it breaks the fever."
Arthur drank it. It burned his throat.
"Miss Ashford?"
"She paid the doctor," Mrs. Gable said plainly. "Said she couldn't afford to lose her best clerk right before the spring audit. Now rest." He was bedridden for 5 days. On the 6th day, he dragged himself out of bed. His legs shook and his chest ached with every breath, but the fever had broken. He dressed in the clean, dry clothes someone had folded on the chair, and he walked downstairs. He found Josephine in the estate office. She was arguing with a grain supplier over the telegraph wire. She finished her transmission and turned, stopping short when she saw him standing in the doorway. "You are out of bed," she noted. Her tone was strictly observational.
"I have been idle for a week, Miss Ashford," Arthur said, his voice raspy. "I'm ready to work."
Josephine looked at him. He was thinner again, the sickness having stripped away the hard-earned bulk of the winter. But he was standing straight. He wasn't asking for pity. "You will not return to the physical labor," she said, sitting down at her desk. "Your lungs cannot take the damp. Thomas has enough hands for the mucking out."
Arthur tensed. "Are you dismissing me?"
"I am promoting you," she replied coldly. She pushed a heavy stack of ledgers across the desk. "You will manage the accounts full time. You will handle the French and Belgian correspondence. You will retain your room in the manor's servant quarters, and your wages are raised to £1 a week. Take these to the side table. The Antwerp numbers need reconciling by noon."
Arthur looked at the ledgers. He looked at the woman who had just saved his life solely because he was a useful asset. It was the most profound kindness he had experienced in a decade. "Yes, Miss Ashford," he said. He took the ledgers and sat down to work.
Summer came to Yorkshire, turning the bleak moors into rolling oceans of vibrant green heather. The estate hummed with the prosperity of a record-breaking shearing season. Arthur's transition to managing the accounts had streamlined the estate's operations. He knew the numbers. He anticipated the market. He worked from dawn until dusk, silent, efficient, and fiercely loyal to the ledgers. It was mid-August when a hired carriage from the York train station rattled into the main courtyard.
Arthur was crossing the gravel with a stack of bank drafts when the carriage stopped. The driver jumped down and opened the door. A woman stepped out. Arthur froze. The bank draft slipped from his fingers, scattering across the white gravel. It was Genevieve. She wore a traveling suit of pale pink silk that was entirely inappropriate for the country dust. She was still beautiful. She would always be beautiful, with her porcelain skin and spun gold hair, but the beauty was brittle now. The silk was slightly frayed at the cuffs. The shadows under her eyes were poorly concealed with powder. She looked around the muddy courtyard, her nose wrinkling in disgust. She saw Arthur. She didn't recognize him at first. She stared at the man in the simple black clerk's suit with his calloused hands, sun-weathered face, and graying hair. Then her eyes widened. "Arthur!" she gasped. She practically threw herself at him, her hands grabbing his lapels. She smelled of heavy rosewater and stale gin. "Oh, Arthur, is it really you, thank God? I didn't believe the rumors in London. What has happened to you? Look at these clothes." Arthur did not embrace her. He did not move. He looked down at the hands gripping his coat. The last time he had seen those hands, they were slipping a diamond ring onto her finger in a Parisian cathedral bought with the money he had stolen from his own future. He felt absolutely nothing. The frantic, obsessive love that had caused him to torch his life to the ground was entirely gone. It was like looking at a stranger, a tired, desperate stranger. "Genevieve," he said, smoothly stepping back to break her hold, "you are trespassing." Genevieve blinked, her mouth opening and closing. "Trespassing, Arthur. It's me, Valerius. He threw me out. He found a younger actress in Naples. I have nothing. The creditors took my trunks. I came to find Josephine. She's my sister. And I knew you were here. We can leave. She has money now. She has to give me my portion of the dowry." "You have no portion," a voice cut like a whip across the courtyard. Genevieve spun around. Josephine stood on the stone steps of the manor. She wore a severe tailored gown of dark navy. She stood perfectly straight, her hands clasped loosely in front of her. She looked like a queen surveying a peasant uprising. "Josie!" Genevieve cried, taking a step toward her. Tears welled in her eyes, the same tears that used to make their father cave to her every whim. "Please, I'm starving. You have to help me." Josephine did not flinch. She walked slowly down the steps. She stopped 2 feet from her sister, examining her with the detached clinical eye of a buyer inspecting a flawed piece of wool. "My name is Miss Ashford," Josephine said. "You forfeited the right to call me anything else 10 years ago. Genevieve's face crumbled into a mask of pure, ugly panic. She turned back to Arthur. "Arthur, tell her she has to take me in. We loved each other. You left her for me." Arthur looked at Josephine. Then he looked at his former wife. "I am Miss Ashford's servant, madam," Arthur said. His voice was perfectly level, stripped of any emotion. "I do not advise her on family matters. I only keep her books." Genevieve stared at him, horrified. "A servant, you are a duke." "I am a clerk," Arthur corrected calmly. He bent down and began gathering the dropped bank drafts from the gravel. "And you are in the way of the supply wagons." Genevieve let out a choked sob. She turned back to Josephine, dropping to her knees on the gravel, ruining the pink silk. "Please, I will do anything. Let me stay." Josephine looked down at her sister. There was no triumph in Josephine's eyes. There was no vindictive glee. There was only a bone-deep weariness. The great defining tragedy of her life was kneeling in the dirt, and it was nothing but a pathetic nuisance.
"Mrs. Gable." Josephine called out to the housekeeper, who was watching from the kitchen door.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Take this woman to the kitchens, give her a hot meal, then have Thomas hitch the trap. He will drive her back to the York station. Give her £20 from the petty cash box. If she ever sets foot on High Cross land again, have the dog set on her." Genevieve wailed a high, piercing sound. £20? I cannot live on £20.
"Then I suggest you find employment," Josephine said, turning her back. "I hear the textile mills in Manchester are always hiring spinners. The work is hard, but it builds character." She walked back up the steps and disappeared into the manor. Arthur finished picking up the papers. He did not look at Genevieve as Mrs. Gable firmly took the weeping woman by the arm and led her away. He simply tapped the papers against his thigh to align them and walked to the estate office. The books had to balance. The silence that settled over High Cross after Genevieve's departure was profound. The ghost had been faced, and it had been found utterly lacking in substance. That evening, Arthur sat at his desk in the office, the glow of an oil lamp illuminating the columns of numbers. The door clicked open. Josephine walked in. She locked the door behind her. Arthur stood up immediately, offering a respectful bow of his head. "Miss Ashford, the quarterly projections are finished. We are running a 12% surplus." "Leave the numbers, Arthur," she said. She walked over to the hearth and stared into the unlit grate. Arthur remained standing. He waited.
"Why didn't you go with her?" Josephine asked quietly. She didn't turn around.
"Because she is an illusion," Arthur answered honestly. "And I am done living in illusions. She was beautiful. She was ruinous." Arthur corrected, his voice hardening slightly. "I chased a pretty flame and it burned me to ash. It took me a decade and losing everything to realize that the fire that keeps a man alive isn't a blinding flash. It's a slow, steady burn. It's the hearth. It's the work."
He looked at her rigid back. "I am exactly where I deserve to be. And I am exactly where I want to be."
Josephine finally turned to face him. The heavy iron vault that had protected her for 10 years seemed for the first time to lower its defenses. She looked at him not as a servant nor as the man who had abandoned her, but as the man he had forced himself to become. A man forged in her mud by her rules. She walked over to his desk. She reached out and picked up his hand. Arthur's breath caught in his throat. He went completely still. She turned his hand over. Her thumb traced the thick calluses on his palm, the rough, scarred skin around his knuckles. Her own hands were just as calloused. Two sets of ruined hands that had rebuilt an empire. 10 shillings a week is insufficient for a man of your capabilities, Josephine said. Her voice was thick, lower than usual. I require nothing more, Miss Ashford.
I am making you the lead steward of High Cross, she stated. She didn't let go of his hand. You will answer only to me. You will manage the foreman. You will take your meals in the main dining room, with me. Arthur looked down at their joined hands. The heat of her touch sent a shockwave through his chest, far more powerful than any fleeting passion he had felt in his youth. This was grounded. This was real. It was terrifying. He slowly lifted his eyes to meet hers. The cynical, hardened spinster and the ruined, disgraced lord. If I dine with you, Arthur said, his voice dropping to a gravelly whisper, I cannot guarantee I will remain a proper servant, Josephine. It was the first time he had used her given name since the night he arrived. Josephine's lips curved into the faintest, smallest ghost of a smile. It was a fierce, dangerous expression.
Good, she said softly. I have enough servants, Arthur. I need a partner.
She let go of his hand, stepped back, and picked up the quarterly projection ledger. She tucked it under her arm. Breakfast is at 6. Do not be late. She unlocked the door and walked out, leaving the scent of wool and rain behind her. Arthur stood alone in the office. He looked at his empty, scarred hands. He walked over to the window, looking out at the sprawling, moonlit acres of the High Cross estate. The wind howled against the glass, cold and unforgiving. But inside, Arthur Pendleton had never felt so warm. He turned down the lamp, locked the office, and went to prepare for the morning. There was work to be done. Do you believe some betrayals can never be forgiven, or is redemption always possible? If the price paid is high enough, Arthur learned that the hardest chains to bear are the ones we forge ourselves, and Josephine proved that the best revenge is simply a life well lived. If you enjoyed this story of ruined resilience and reversed fortunes, please hit the like button. Subscribe to the channel for more deeply human historical dramas. And share this video with someone who needs a reminder of their own strength. Let me know your thoughts in the comments below.